good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 21st of May, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here today on a Juneau afternoon. Mark Wheeler hosts an hour of science-related interviews. Guest Tom Ainsworth will talk about predicting the weather. Mike Heckers will be highlighting glacier research. And Bill Lady will explore alternative energy and global warming. Ed Ryder's Almanac Bird on Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight, rain likely, low temperatures around 46 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, cloudy skies with scattered showers and high temperatures around 57 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday looks like mostly cloudy skies with isolated showers and high temperatures around 57 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Oregon Board of Education voted last week for schools to retire their Indian mascots. KWSO's William Robbins has more.
8 high schools in Oregon will need to change their nickname and mascot by July 2017 or face losing state money. The ban includes team mascots whose names are the Braves, the Chieftains, and Indians. 7 other high schools that identify as the Warriors will have to drop logos and mascots that depict Native Americans. Since the 1970s, more than 600 high school and college teams have dropped Native American nicknames, including 20 in Oregon. But some small communities have resisted the trend, saying their nickname is a source of pride and tradition. Siadam Edmo is with the Oregon Indian Education Association. She says the mascots that are banned foster negative stereotypes.
It's about objectification, and any objectification is discrimination. And discrimination is a tool of racism. So no matter how small that racism might be, it's still racism, and it has no place in our public schools.
The Oregon Board of Education received hundreds of comments, slightly more in favor of the ban than against, most of who were opposed that it is a waste of time and infringes on local control. In Oregon, I'm Will Robbins.
During a hearing in the House Natural Resources Committee last week, Alaska Congressman Don Young's Native American Energy Act was passed. Emily Schwing reports.
Among other actions, the bill establishes 5 Indian Energy Development Offices within the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Representative Young says the legislation also holds plaintiffs rather than defendants liable when an energy development project on Indian or Alaskan Native corporation land is delayed by what he's calling frivolous lawsuits. Young also passed an amendment to his bill that voids the Department of Interior rule dealing with hydraulic fracturing or fracking on tribal lands unless the landowner gives express consent.
And this is a classic example of Big Brother interfering with private lands, really. They're native lands. If they don't want to have the regulations, then they ought to be able to take and develop their lands as they see fit.
Young says the fracking rule makes tribal lands less competitive for development. He told the committee he's concerned that bureaucracy keeps too many energy development projects on native lands from moving forward. There's no word yet on when the bill will be heard on the House floor. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing.
Native Americans commemorated the Bloody Island Massacre over the weekend in Lake County, California. The 1850 massacre by white settlers killed a near entire village of Pomo people. Christina Onnestad reports.
About 100 people gathered for the 13th annual Bloody Island Memorial. Clayton Duncan is an organizer. His grandmother was one of the few survivors of the 1850 massacre.
So they played this game they call hide and go seek. They ream out tule reeds, and they go under the water in the tules, and they breathe underwater. That's how they survive while all around them, you know, people were being murdered.
The massacre was in retaliation to the murder of Andrew Kelsey, a white settler who enslaved and raped local Pomo Indians. A town in Lake County remains named after him, Kelseyville. Duncan has worked to change the town's name to no avail, yet. Descendants of the survivors and other local Native Americans gather here each year to commemorate the Bloody Island Massacre. Again, Duncan.
It's an act of honoring the people that they did it to and forgiving the oppressor or America for what they've done.
For National Native News, I'm Christina Onnestad.
On this day in 1987, Acoma tribal members held a demonstration to oppose the creation of the El Malpais National Monument in western New Mexico. Acoma Pueblo had vested interests in the land, including numerous cultural and spiritual holdings. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
I'm Billy Mills. As a grandfather and Olympic athlete, I know the importance of keeping kids healthy. The Children's Health Insurance Program in your state can provide your child additional health coverage, such as dental care, vision care, and emergency services. Enrolling your child can also help maximize health resources at your travel clinic. To learn more, contact your clinic or call 1-877-KIDS-NOW or visit insurekidsnow.gov.
Sponsored by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Good afternoon. It's 3:05. You're listening to KTOO News in Juneau. I'm Mark Wheeler here on Juneau Afternoon, sitting in for Jeff Brown. And we're going to talk a little science today. Have some local science folks here in the studio. And first with me is Tom Ainsworth from the Juneau Forecast Office. Welcome, Tom.
Good afternoon, Mark.
So, Tom, tell me what your job is there at the Weather Service.
Well, in a nutshell, we're predicting the weather to help save lives and property. That's our mission statement for the National Weather Service. My particular job is I supervise 22 excellent employees that do everything from weather forecasting to keep all our equipment working and running in A shape.
So do you ever get to do the weather forecast yourself?
Hey, I do. I get a chance out there. It's I think if I figured it out, it'd be about 10 or 15% of the year my turn out on the forecast desk.
And so you stay sharp.
I stay current anyways. Yeah, they teach me a lot while I'm out there.
All right. So how big of an area do you guys cover? What's the size of your responsibility?
Well, our area of responsibility is all of the panhandle of southeast Alaska and the eastern half of the Gulf of Alaska. It turns out to be about 150,000 square miles, and that's the third largest area of responsibility of the entire National Weather Service in terms of forecast offices. Of course, the first two are Anchorage and Fairbanks, have a little bit bigger area than we do. So basically all of southeast Alaska from the Canadian border out to the middle of the Gulf of Alaska.
Wow. So that is just like the A-leagues in terms of the Weather Service to make it to Alaska?
Well, it is, in my opinion. It's a beautiful place to live and work. And one thing that's really great about forecasting the weather in southeast Alaska is we have a very appreciative audience, a very savvy audience that uses weather information to their benefit and provides constructive feedback when necessary. And so it's people that we relate to tend to know a lot about how the weather works, and that's pretty fulfilling as a forecaster.
So you hear a lot from the public.
We get our fair share of feedback on how well we're doing.
Yeah. Is it tough sometimes? Or?
Sometimes it is, naturally, criticism. But if you just take it for what it's worth, then everybody out there really wants to do the best job that they can. And if we can learn something from someone who's been to parts of southeast Alaska we've never been to yet and can give us the local characteristics for the weather and weather phenomena there, typically the feedback might be it's a lot windier there than you predicted, or it's not as windy as you predicted, or it's not as snowy as you predicted, things along those lines. And those all go into a mental and logistic database for us that we can pull out later when the weather events come back the same way.
Hmm. And what first got you interested in meteorology?
Well, probably several things. I grew up in the eastern Great Lakes, and so we had what we called lake effect snowstorms. And one in particular dumped 100 inches in 3 days in my hometown. And it was the only time my dad allowed us to come out of the upstairs bedroom windows with all our snow clothes on and handed us shovels at the bottom of the hill so that we had to literally dig out the front door of the house. So that stuck with me as a childhood memory. And then I guess just leaning towards science, it was the age of Apollo and the moon landings and rockets and jets and all these things in the air combined with weather just all led to me wanting to learn more and more about it and end up getting my degree in meteorology.
And what all do you need in terms of a background there for meteorology?
Well, it's considered an atmospheric science, which is basically a fluid dynamics sort of background. So there's math and physics, a little bit of chemistry and all that stuff. So it's basically trying to first see the invisible, the atmosphere, and then understanding what nudges it and how it responds to certain nudgings, whether it's being pushed into a mountain or down a river or over the ocean, and then taking that information and knowing how it's going to respond, utilize the advantage of numerical weather prediction or weather models. And basically, we're analyzing what the current conditions are. We're diagnosing how those current conditions will change over time, and then we're prognosing or predicting what the future will hold. And then we start all over again and do it again.
And do you look at, like, oh, we were wrong here, try to adjust the models, or how do you look at your track record, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. What you typically do when you come on, first thing is that we are a 24/7 operation, so we are always open and always working. And so when you're at the office, the first thing you want to do is try to understand what's been happening since you were last there as a forecaster. Did your last forecast pan out? How well, or how hot, warm, cold, wet, rainy, whatever, how's it been? And then try to use the information from the observing network that we have, whether it's radars or satellite pictures or volunteer weather observers or whatever we can piece together to build this picture of a three-dimensional atmosphere. And then go forward from there with what we've learned from experience and our education and knowing the climatology of the area.
Huh. So what does it mean then when you say 100% chance of rain? Does that really mean 100%?
Well, when we use percentage of probability there, that sort of relates to the forecaster's confidence in something occurring. And the chance of rain, by definition, only means enough. It means 1/100th of an inch, which is basically enough to make a puddle. So if it's just going to spit a few drops on you, we don't really consider that measurable rain. We need enough that we can stick a ruler into the rain gauge and actually have the ruler get wet. So the probability of precipitation, whether it's 70%, 80%, 100%, is sort of a measure of the forecaster's confidence of at least some measurable rain occurring. It could be very brief, could be significant rain in a short period of time, or it could be very, very light rain over a long period of time.
And does it mean, you're forecasting for all of Juneau then, right?
That's right. The forecast areas in southeast Alaska are divided up into 17 what we call zones, and they're supposedly representing climatologically similar areas. So we have a Juneau zone, we have a Skagway zone, we have a Ketchikan zone, a Sitka zone. And so each of those areas we're forecasting individually. So we may have a very wet, cold forecast for one part of the panhandle and something entirely different at the other end of the panhandle.
It seems like it must be really tricky for Juneau, since it could be completely different out the road than the weather downtown. So how do you figure that?
Well, that's really one of the hardest things to do as a forecaster, is to concisely convey all the complexity that's really occurring. And I think that's what makes a really good forecaster, is someone who can take all the things that are going on, which is a very complex, dynamic, changing system every hour, and convey it to our customers in a way that they find useful and understandable and meaningful.
So why is it so different around Juneau, the weather?
Well, the topography certainly has a lot to do with it. So the air swirls and moves around islands and mountains and creates different weather. There's an old saying in weather forecasting, mountains make their own weather. And so... basically, the climatology of Juneau, the weather frequently comes in from the south and west. And as it arrives, it hits downtown Juneau and the mountains behind the Juneau, and it tends to make more clouds and squeeze more precipitation out. As you go further north, there's actually some phenomenons on the north side of Douglas Island out in the Auk Bay area and a little bit out toward Lena Point where the opposite occurs, is that the precipitation actually decreases a little bit. So just how the weather, the winds, the currents all affect or interplay, I guess, with the topography here is really the biggest challenge that you start with as a forecaster.
Huh. And what about the Taku winds? Where do they come from?
Well, they come out of the Taku, of course. but seriously, what the Taku winds are is is what we call a mountain wave wind. And I guess it distinguishes itself. Normally, wind will travel through the mountains in a way of finding the least resistance. So it'll go up the channels or through the river valleys and things like that. Conversely, a mountain wave wind is a wind that's blowing over the mountains perpendicular to the ridge line. So it's basically a waterfall of wind that's coming in the Taku case, it's coming out of Canada typically. And then the atmospheric conditions are such that the winds, which typically increase in speed as you go higher into the atmosphere, so in our ridges around here are 3,000 to 5,000 feet. So those wind speeds at that level are actually forced downward in the Gatineau Channel, and it's basically a waterfall of wind. And some of the principles are like putting your thumb over a garden hose and having the water accelerate and go farther and faster and things like that. The atmosphere can actually do the same thing, where it forces wind from above to subside lower and lower in elevation, but it still squeezes over the top of the mountain. So there's air that's squirting over the top of the mountain at very high speeds. Huh. And if things are just right, it'll blow pretty significantly high from about the Juneau Bridge down to South Douglas there.
Now, I've heard some old-timers here say that we used to have them really bad, and then we didn't have them for a while, and now we're getting them again. Is that true? Are we entering a phase of more chaku winds now?
I think there's something to be said about personal experience and lifetimes. I mean, 70, 80 years in terms of the planet is a very short period of time, and weather seasons and tendencies can go in those kind of cycles too. For example, a climatological normal period is considered 30 years. So we're trying to see things, how they pan out, try to take out all the extreme events and just kind of see what the mean conditions are over about a 30-year period. So for us that are alive a couple of those 30-year periods, we may see a difference from what they supposedly used to be. But now, in terms of the age of the planet and Southeast Alaska, are they increasing or decreasing? That's certainly a good question for future researchers to help us figure out.
Well, tell me about the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. Is that happening? Is that a real thing?
Well, it certainly is a connection there. It's an interesting phenomenon over the last 20 years or so that we've learned that there is a connection between what's happening in the ocean to what's happening in the atmosphere. And basically, with the Pacific Ocean being as large as it is, that currents and pressure patterns of wind move the water. We create upwelling. We change the ocean surface temperatures from warm to cold. We change where the low pressures and high pressures are situated. And basically, what the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is, or the PDO, is basically about a 20-year heartbeat of things going kind of back and forth in different directions over the ocean. The net result is that we see changes in sea surface temperatures, which affects things such as salmon runs, changes the flow of the direction of the weather quite a bit. So we might have drier decades and wetter decades. So we're just starting to learn that these connections exist. And the next step, of course, is to learn more about them and try to predict them in the future.
So are we entering a wet phase or a cold phase of that?
We're still in a cold phase, and again, when that'll change is anyone's guess. But cold phase is relative. I think what they tend to be is a little bit more of the winter snow type of situation. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to be drier or wetter. And again, these are averaged over long, long periods of time, so we can still have very hot or warm winters, or very wet or dry winters in between. So it's a long-term scale of planetary movement. Yeah.
Try to nail things down, right?
It is. It's so exciting, and I think that's what meteorologists really like about what they do, is because it's such a fluid profession, and things are changing every day, and you have to go back and see if your ideas are still valid tomorrow, and makes it fun to go to work.
So we don't know if the next 5 years of Eagle Crest are going to be epic years like we had this year.
Well, we can all hope so. There is some consensus on the evolution of what we're calling climate change in Southeast Alaska. What's being observed is a little bit warmer winters, but also wetter winters. And the warmer is sort of interesting. It's the mean temperature over many months, of course, but what we've noticed in the last 30 years, comparing 30 years before that, is the warmth has been most notable from the morning low temperatures are warmer, not necessarily the afternoon temperatures. So that's one thing. And if winters are going to be wetter, like is being predicted, at some elevation, it's still going to be snow. We're not going to have above freezing temperatures all the way to the top of the hill. So you know, depending on your outlook, it could be some pretty snowy winters coming along here for the elevation that our ski area is at.
Well, I hope so. So what do you think about the summer? You have any predictions for the summer for us?
Well, we better do something. People are all talking about how cool it's been. It's been remarkably cool May. Last check last week, we're on the order of about 11 degrees below normal
for
the month, which is a figure that we measure in tenths of degrees. So this is really bordering on a historic May in terms of coolness. But really, our winter was just slightly above average temperature. And if we can remember back to April, that was a pretty darn month. That was above average temperature. So, again, how things pan out, what the summer will end up being above or below. But this May is really a strong anomaly. It's not what we've been having. And technically, the outlook for the summer is to be cool for about the next month. And then there's no real significant scientific signal that says we're going to be continued cool or start to warm or anything like that. We are obviously getting into our warmest time of year, June and July, and the forecast of even 60, 65 degree days are starting to creep into the forecast now, and it's going to feel a lot better than it was just a few weeks ago where we woke up and we had snow on the hillsides.
Yeah, cool. So any exciting new things happening at the Weather Service you want to tell us about?
Well, probably a couple things come to mind. One is digital weather services, and the other would be trying to convey societal impacts in our weather forecasts. With digital weather services, we're trying to move from the straight text products and analog radio, VHF radio broadcasts, to something a little bit more interactive online and on smartphones and things like that. And one of the things that we're really kind of happy and pleased to announce this spring was what we call our point forecast. And the forecast area that I mentioned earlier, 150,000 square miles, is basically made up of a 3 kilometer square blocks, if you can imagine. So about roughly the area of our airport from side to side, north to south. Well, all those blocks now, we're trying to come up with a forecast of temperature, wind speed, probability, precipitation, all those things for that individual spot. So whether that's your favorite fishing hole out in Lynn Canal, or whether it's your ski place, or whether it's your cabin up the Taku, we're trying to take this whole Juneau broad forecast area and make it a little bit more specific. Now, with that, and being a new service, we are interested in to hear some of the feedback on how that's working out. But that's available online. And I think if you experiment with our webpage, which is weather.gov/Juneau, you'll be taken to a map where you can really just auger down in with clicking away and go right to your point of interest. The societal impacts story is moving a little bit beyond just predicting the weather to trying to help people understand what that impact will mean. So a good example is a winter storm, lots of snow and things like that. But if we add the fact that this might be enough of a storm to cancel ferry sailings, or if we think that snow will reduce visibility enough that we think flights may be impacted in and out of Juneau, which may mean that cargo may or may not get here, or the barge runs with the groceries on them might be a day or two late, those sorts of things. So that's a new area for us, and we're working with our partners, everything from emergency response officials, such as the Coast Guard, the Emergency Management Services, and all the communities in Southeast, and trying to learn what is it about weather forecasts that really catches your attention? What is it when I say it's going to blow 70 and be snowing sideways, what comes to mind to you as a community official? And so we're getting that feedback now, and some ideas that we have down the road are perhaps maybe a weather scale. On a scale of 1 to 5, the impact's going to be a 3, which means something. It's not just a wind speed or something like that, but it means, roads might be closed or avalanches probability might increase or something along that line. So we're taking a stab at learning how communities actually apply the weather forecast and trying to incorporate that into the weather prediction itself.
That sounds exciting.
It's a great mix of physical science and social science and interacting with our customers. As a service provider, we just want to make sure we're providing what people find most useful.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Tom.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. We're back on Juneau Afternoon. It's 3:26. This is KTOO News in Juneau. I'm here with Mike Heckers from UAS. Thanks for being with us, Mike.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity, Mark.
So tell me, what's your role there at UAS?
Well, I wear three different hats at UAS. My main job is to manage some computer labs and equipment for the environmental science and geography programs. And I also teach classes for those two programs. And in my spare time, I get to do glacier research, research that was started by Roman Motyka in the late 90s. And he sort of passed it off to UAS, and it's sort of my job to keep monitoring the Mendenhall Glacier and how it's been changing.
What's happening to the glacier?
Well, it's as we all know, it's retreating. The last couple of years, it's been retreating a little faster than in the late 2000s. Late 2000s, we were seeing about 60 meters of retreat a year, and just the last 2 years, we've had almost twice that, 130 to 160 meters of retreat a year. So as the glacier's been thinning, it's retreating into some really deep water. So the ice is just more buoyant and therefore breaks up much more easily.
Huh. And so do you have predictions of what's going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years?
We're going to see continued retreat. A couple years ago, we had bets as to when it was going to sort of retreat out of the lake, and I think all bets are off because nobody really knows. And Roman Motyka has some data from his earlier studies that show there might be kind of a valley that goes back that doesn't have rock in it. So the glacier might be retreating back kind of into this little valley. So it probably be a good number of years before we see at least the glacier come out of the lake anyway.
So what are the big factors that are influencing? Is it just where it's calving into, or is it global warming, or what are the big factors at play?
Well, the big factors, couple different things. The Mendenhall is still kind of a little bit of a relic of the Little Ice Age. The Little Ice Age, you know, was peaked about 300 years ago, and we all know that the glacier was about 3 miles longer, you know, extended down past, you know, the Back Loop Road there and into those neighborhoods. And so we're still shrinking from that, but also, you know, it's a lacustrine glacier, so that's a fancy term for Lake Cavan Glacier. So that's definitely affected the amount of ice loss due to calving. It really ever since kind of 2004 when it retreated in there. But, you know, global warming does have a definite impact on the glacier and where that snow line is on the glacier. Typically in Southeast Alaska, we'll see the snow line right about 3,100 feet or so, the end of season snow line.
What do you mean?
Well, if you look at, if you fly up in the glacier in, say, early September, you'll see bare ice up until about 3,000, 3,400 feet, depending on where you are.
Uh-huh.
So above that, there's snow left over from that winter. So as we get into further warming, that end-of-season snow line, or we call it the equilibrium line altitude, that is going to slowly creep up higher and higher and therefore eat away more of the glacier's area that is typically a spot where the snow accumulates.
So it kind of insulates it against melting or no?
Well, it's really kind of a balance. A good healthy glacier will have about 70% of its area in that accumulation zone. There'll
uh-huh.
still be snow left over on 70% of a good healthy land terminating glacier. And the Mendenhall, it's varied in the late 2000s from 45-50% of the whole area was still had snow left over to, you know, up to 70% in the best years. So we're seeing a lot of basically more melt than accumulation. That's the overall story.
And what's going on with the Taku? Why is that advancing?
Yeah, the Taku is it's a tidewater glacier, and there's a whole sort of cycle of the tidewater advance. And right now, of course, it's not really calving in the tidewater, but it used to be. We know in the late 1800s, it was several miles further up valley, and it's been advancing because basically sediment builds up in front of the glacier and then sort of impedes its advance. Huh. So it goes slower and slower and doesn't calve catastrophically. So a good example of that is the Hubbard Glacier outside of Yakutat. But the Taku generally has a lot of area that is at high elevations. So almost 80% of its total area has been in the accumulation zone, or
it's a healthier glacier.
It's a much healthier glacier, okay. Yeah. And it's still been retreating. I've heard some stories of maybe a little thinning in some spots at the terminus, but it's been steadily advancing, probably 15 to 25 meters a year over the last decade anyway.
Huh. But then overall, if you look at Southeast Alaska and all the glaciers we have, what are they? Some of them advancing, some retreating, most of them advancing, most retreating. What's the scenario?
That's a good question. Most are retreating. Uh-huh. Really, it's just those glaciers like the Hubbard and the Taku that have higher accumulation zones. The Hubbard really comes off like the Mount Logan Massif in Canada. So it's got a really high accumulation zone, and over 90% of that glacier's area is sort of in that accumulation zone. So it's going to be advancing for quite a while. The Taku, it's a little bit more susceptible to change because little changes in that end of season snow line will really eat away at the total glacier area because the glacier is not very steep down low, unlike the Hubbard Glacier, which the lower portions are fairly steep. So a change in elevation of that snow line really won't make as much of a difference. But region-wide, there's massive ice loss on the Stikine ice field. Of course, our local Juneau glaciers, the Lemon Creek, Mendenhall, Herbert, and the Eagle, they're all retreating.
And the Davies, that one retreating too?
Pretty much all of them but the Taku in our local area. Taku and, its twin glacier that also spills from the Taku.
Is the Davies still calving off that huge fall,
I'm not sure. I haven't been out there in a while. Oh. But, I know most of them along that whole corridor are all retreating pretty dramatically.
I think that's one of the spectacular things I've ever seen in Juneau is the Davies Glacier calving off that cliff down to the huge cloud of snow and just sounds like thunder. Hopefully they'll still be around a few more years. But tell me about this. How do you say this? Jokulhulp? How do you say that?
Jokulhulp.
Jokulhulp.
Yeah, that's sort of my best American pronunciation of that word. I'm sure in Icelandic it's pronounced a little differently, but, Jokulhulp, yeah. So that's a glacier outburst event, and that's what we saw last summer that caused the flooding in the Mendenhall Glacier Valley. So that's when ice physically dams up water, usually on the side of a glacier. So, and that was pretty much the case for the Jokulhulp that happened last summer. And these have been going on as long as we know. You can see, if you hike up the West Glacier Trail in the summertime, you can see some lakes forming on the side, like between Mount Strollerwhite, Mount McGinnis. Huh. Those drain catastrophically as well, too. But, most of them are a lot smaller than what we experienced last summer.
So do you think we'll have more in the future? What do you think?
Definitely. But they're completely unpredictable. Because right now, the waterfall that was flowing out of the right side of the glacier face there, it's totally shut off. So the water is probably draining from underneath the glacier at the terminus face. So as the melt season progresses, maybe it'll turn back on, probably. But Yeah, we don't know how that yokolip will form this year. If it does, I'm sure it will to some extent, but whether or not it'll be, you know, a big sort of community-wide event remains to be seen.
Huh. So any other projects you're really excited about that you want to talk about today?
Well, we're going to try to monitor what these yokolips do to ice speed and whether or not they create little ice quakes. So Professor Jason Amundsen at UAS has started a program where we're going to try to monitor that. And it's kind of in modeled after a program that some other folks have done on the Lemon Creek Glacier. So we've got a good idea of how much it increases the glacier's velocity and for how long. It's usually a short-term event lasting 2.5 to 3 days tops, but it can make the glacier change from, you know, centimeters a day movement to up to a meter a day.
Wow.
So like a hundredfold increase. It's still, that's only for 2 days, but, you know, pretty dramatic event. And, you know, in some cases, like the Taku outburst events, those cause flooding too.
Well, great, Mike. Anything else you want to add we didn't talk about today?
The Juneau Ice Field is just an amazing spot. And, you know, if you haven't had the opportunity to go up there, whether flight seeing or going up for a short ski trip, it's a great place to just really kind of discover how humbling and big and vast this physical barrier is, that is the Juneau Ice Field.
Yeah. So will you come on later and tell about your trip up there?
Yes. I just did a 12-day trip where me and a couple of friends skied from Juneau to Skagway, and it was a fascinating trip. Yeah, lots of stories to tell.
Great.
From that.
We'll have you back on and talk about that.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, see you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 21st of May, 2012. It's the birthday of Alexander Pope, London, 1688. Catholic family, and there was a wave of anti-Catholic sentiment in England at the time, so he was not allowed to attend public school. His aunt taught him to read, a priest taught him Latin and Greek, and he fell in love with the works of Homer when he was only 8. He developed tuberculosis, which affected his bones and stunted his growth. He was a hunchback, about 4'6" tall. Not many of his poems are read today, but he's very often quoted. It was Alexander Pope who said, "To err is human, to forgive divine, and fools rush in where angels fear to tread." Pope said, "A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pierian spring." And it was Alexander Pope who said, "Be not the first by whom the new are tried, nor yet the last to lay the old aside." And it's the birthday of the poet Robert Creeley, born Arlington, Massachusetts, 1926. He was 2 years old, riding in the car with his father, when a piece of coal hit the car, shattered the windshield, a piece of glass went in the boy's eye, which then had to be removed. His mother moved the family to a farm in rural Massachusetts. Creeley said, "Growing up with 5 women in the house, it was like growing up in a forest attended by wolves. Went to Harvard, then dropped out. He wanted to be a writer, but he spent a few years drinking too much, getting in fights. After the birth of his son, he moved the family to a chicken farm in New Hampshire." And Creeley said, "I learned more about poetry as an actual activity from raising chickens than I did from any professor." Robert Creeley published more than 60 books before his death in 2005. The poet Charles Olson was a great influence on him. Creeley said, "Olson taught me how to write, not how to write poems that he wrote, but how to write poems that I write," a very curious and specific difference. Here's a poem for today, some lines from Alexander Pope's An Essay on Man. "All are but parts of one stupendous whole, whose body nature is, and God the soul. that changed through all and yet in all the same, great in the earth as in the ethereal frame, warms in the sun, refreshes in the breeze, glows in the stars and blossoms in the trees, lives through all life, extends through all extent, spreads undivided, operates unspent, breathes in our soul, informs our mortal part, as full as perfect in a hair as heart, as full as perfect in vile man that mourns, as the rapt seraphim that sings and burns. To him no high, no low, no great, no small. He fills, he bounds, connects, and equals all. All nature is but art, unknown to thee, all chance, direction, which thou canst not see, all discord, harmony, not understood, all partial evil, universal good. Wrote Alexander Pope in An Essay on Man. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, offering online review, monitoring, and management services for businesses that know the importance of online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. And by Nook, Simple Touch with Glow Light by Barnes & Noble. Designed for bedtime reading, Glow Light offers paper-like reading with the lights on or off. Available at neighborhood Barnes & Noble stores or Nook.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Good afternoon. We're back on Junior Afternoon. I'm Mark Wheeler sitting in for Jeff Brown. It's 3:43. You're listening to KTO News in Juneau. With me here in the studio is Bill Lady with Alaska Applied Sciences. Welcome, Bill.
I'm glad to be here. It's great. Thank you, Mark.
So, Bill, tell me about your background.
Oh, I'm a science fair nerd. Grew up in Iowa. Competed in the local science fair all 4 years and managed to get to the National Science Fair in 61 when I graduated. And I've been doing science fair projects ever since, including at Alaska Applied Sciences, Inc.
And what do you do with the company?
We have a wind plant in Palm Springs, California, 14 wind generators in a row. We bought those for next to nothing 20-some years ago with the idea that we would improve the design as well as making electricity from the wind to feed back into the Southern California Edison grid, sort of an R&D project. And we built a computer-guided telescope for the Hyatt Regency Maui so that people could see the stars and the sky better and have a little better understanding of who and where and what we humans are. Put us in perspective a little bit.
And you're really interested in global climate change, I take it, right?
Energy and the way we have been using it and continue to use it seems to be the cause of rapid climate change. That's the problem. Climate's always changing up and down, but the rapid climate change we've seen over the last decades and century is the problem. And energy seems to be the key, the source of that problem. So let's fix the energy system.
So how did you get interested in that topic?
Oh, I'm an engineer by training, so I've always been interested in things like that. But I began following the climate research that was beginning to be published a couple decades ago. You remember right after the Rio Earth Summit, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, was formed. And they began serious research. There's several thousand climate scientists from all around the world. And as Lord Brown, who was the head of BP, said when he gave a major speech at his alma mater, Stanford grad school a few years ago, there's a lot of noise in the data, but it's clear that the trend is in the wrong direction and we need to take corrective action. That might have been the source of BP calling itself Beyond Petroleum. But it seems like I could help there with my engineering and business training and experience, and I have spent the last 11 years pro bono for our family foundation that my father started 26, 27 years ago, co-authoring research papers on a particular aspect of converting the world's energy system to run entirely on renewables.
So how are we going to do that? How do we do that?
Well, first you recognize that this little spaceship Earth on which we find ourselves has only one source of income, and that's radiant energy from the sun, the little meteor dust, but that doesn't amount to much. And everything else is capital. So we're spending our capital, we're burning the fossil fuels, we're changing the composition of the atmosphere, we're extinguishing species as a result of that, causing the ocean to become more acidified. Can't continue. That's not sustainable. So eventually, and the sooner the better, we need to run the world on renewables. That's my mantra.
But tell me how. What does that look like?
First, you recognize that there's plenty of renewable source energy. There's more sunlight hitting the Earth than we need for 1,000 human civilizations as we know them now. And the sunlight manifests itself as wind and tidal energy. That's the moon's effect primarily. There's plenty of renewable source energy. We just need to harvest it, transmit it to where it's needed, and store it because the sun goes down and the wind stops blowing so that we have a firm energy supply. People want the lights to always go on. So the obvious way to do that is to put in more electric lines so we can move more of this renewable source energy. But electricity doesn't store very well. So that's why the papers I've been co-authoring these last 11 years have focused on an alternative to electricity for transmission, firming storage, and integration of that time-varying output, renewable supply, the sun going down and the wind stopping to blow. And those attractive alternatives look like converting that electric energy right at the wind plant or the solar plant to either hydrogen or anhydrous ammonia fuels, so the only two carbon-free fuels that nature has given us. Now we can transmit it in pipelines, and we can store it very inexpensively. Now you and your green friends are not fighting these new electric lines that we have to build otherwise to get that renewable source energy from where the richest resources are. We know that Alaska has a huge amount of renewable source energy, but it's all stranded. It's far from markets with no transmission. So that's what I've been working on, my special contribution.
So then it would look like, say, out in western Alaska where they have a bunch of wind, you would take the wind and generate, you'd fix hydrogen out there and then tanker it somewhere? What would you do?
Probably not hydrogen for Alaska. Uh-huh. That would probably be a good choice in the lower 48 where everything can be tied together in a continental pipeline system. We've already done that with both electricity and natural gas pipelines. So we could easily build a hydrogen pipeline network or put the hydrogen right in the natural gas pipeline system we already have and deliver a mixed fuel. But in Alaska, anhydrous ammonia, NH3, looks much more attractive because it can be transported as a liquid. Hydrogen is very difficult to liquefy. It has to be minus 253 degrees C. So anhydrous ammonia, NH3, is the other hydrogen. It's a very compact hydrogen carrier because it can be liquefied very easily. And yes, we can move it around in tankers. It's really windy out in the Aleutians, nobody there. So tanker loads of ammonia made from the wind could be shipped around the world. Ammonia is the second most traded industrial chemical in the world. Only sulfuric acid is higher volume. And we already have the infrastructure for it.
So then what do you do with that ammonia, say, with a car or or a bus? What happens there?
Well, the obvious things to do with it are pipe it into this building or your house where we have a combined heat and power plant right in our building. We make our own electricity, and no conversion process or machine is 100% efficient, so we're going to have some byproduct heat. Never say waste heat now. We don't want to waste anything. Byproduct heat, which we can use to heat or cool our building. And transportation fuel. The internal combustion engine runs very well on ammonia. And the combustion turbine and the fuel cell also run on ammonia. So we can carry it around in tanks as liquid fuel on our vehicles as we know them now and run our power plants on this source of carbon-free, renewable source driven by the sun, Earth's only source of income. That's how we can do it.
But you don't hear much about ammonia in the news. Why is that?
Because not many people have bothered to advocate this alternative. And in my experience, transmission is synonymous with electricity. It's very difficult to get people in the renewables industry. I just came from the World Renewables Energy Forum in Denver last week. Secretary Chu from the Department of Energy talked to us and other people. it's really difficult to get those folks to think of anything other than electric wires. After all, if your only tool's a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If your only product is electricity, the world looks like wires. It's very difficult to get them to think about anything else.
So there's no big ammonia lobby out there pushing.
No. But our small company has applied for one of the Emerging Energy Technology Fund grants administered by Alaska Energy Authority. It's a product of SB 220 that was passed 2 years ago by the legislature. It took a year to get the regulations in place. And then in April, they received 70 abstract applications for this Emerging Energy Technology Fund. Now, this is something like the Renewable Energy Fund that we've spent $180 million on so far, well, I think with pretty good results. That's designed to put projects in the ground that are going to be fairly low risk. They're going to work. This is for emerging energy technology. So this is designed to handle more risk. So we have applied for an R&D and demonstration grant from that fund to show that renewable source electricity can be used to make anhydrous ammonia fuel at the village scale. It could be stored very inexpensively to provide year-round energy independence, or a degree of it anyway, and then we could consider exporting our large-scale renewables as liquid ammonia fuel in tankers. So that's what we're trying to do at a commercial level. After all, business eventually has to make this happen, and we're talking about the world's largest industry, energy, right. The world's largest industry.
So I heard Iceland was talking about converting their whole fishing fleet to hydrogen, and maybe that's been delayed. But could we do that in Southeast Alaska? Could we have like ammonia running our fishing fleets? Is that too fantastical to think about?
No, not fantastic at all. Except we don't have enough renewable source energy harvested yet. For example, here in Juneau, we have a lot of renewable source energy as hydroelectric delivered by ALNP from its almost dozen. Hydro generating plants, but we don't have enough to provide our transportation fuel as for our fleet as we know it now. But if we prioritized and said, let's run our bus fleet and our fishing fleet on ammonia made from renewable source energy, hydro, or whatever else we have around here, yes, we could do that. The engines can be modified. The engines that we're now driving can be modified. It might be more practical to produce engines that are optimized to run on ammonia in this case, because it's much easier to transport on board a fishing boat or your car or bus or mine. And then we'd need another supply of renewable source electricity to make that ammonia to provide that fuel. But Alaska, Southeast, could be a real demonstration, R&D and demonstration site for that. And that's what we've advocated in the Renewable Energy Cluster Working Group. You remember the Forest Service contracted with JEDC to conduct, it's been over a year now, this cluster working group for visitor products, ocean products, forest products, and renewable source energy. And renewable energy is the one for which no industry exists yet. So this would be a new cluster industry for renewable energy that we're trying to see if it might form here to try to take advantage of this economic opportunity. All this renewable energy and what to do with it.
So you'd have these hydro plants near water producing ammonia, is that what you're saying?
Could be.
These isolated hydro sites around Southeast?
That's right. Could be. Not only hydro. We have wind, we have solar, the sun shines not as well as it does in the desert, so that's probably not our best. But all along the outer coast, we have wave energy. Now there's no off-the-shelf economical way to harvest that yet, but a lot of people are working on that. And then tidal energy. We know what the tide does around here. If we have a way of impounding that and forcing it to run through our turbines to generate electricity from all this massive water movement, we have a diverse array of renewables as well as biomass.
So it seems like the policy debate has kind of shifted maybe in terms of a headwind against these kind of things, or, you know, even acknowledging that global climate change is caused by humans.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder what gives you hope in this whole struggle you've been involved in? What keeps you going?
I know that technically and economically it probably makes sense. Now, the whole renewables industry is sidetracked now in the lower 48, which is much bigger market than Alaska, of course, by very low-cost gas made from fracking, the shale gale, some people call it. It's very hard for renewable energy to compete with gas, natural gas, at $2 or $3 a million BTU, as it is in the lower 48. So that's a setback, but it's only temporary. So we've got 100 years of gas. What are we going to do then? We need to start right now preparing for what we're going to do 50 or 60 years from now when we have to transition away from natural gas. And if we find that there's a methane leakage problem, and methane, CH4, is 20-some times as effective a heat-trapping gas as CO2, and if we're going to produce natural gas, we're going to burn it, and that's going to make CO2 only half as much as if you burn coal for the same amount of energy, but still CO2 going in the atmosphere. So that's not a long-term solution. So that it gives me hope that we'll eventually come to our senses and say, if we can just agree, we need to run the world on renewables. That should be our goal as humanity and as Americans and as business people and Alaskans. If we can agree on that, then I think the other pieces will fall into place.
But you're not afraid we'll realize that too late?
It's already too late. We should have done this 50 years ago. The CO2 is already in the atmosphere. It's going to be there for centuries, perhaps. The pH of the ocean is already decreasing. Damage is already being done. But to just shrink back in denial and say, too bad, there's nothing we can do about it, it's just not acceptable to me. That's not the way I think or care to operate. And my dying day, I'd like to feel a little better about myself for at least having tried.
Well, thanks, Bill. I hope we can all join in with you with hope. But anything else you want to mention while we have you on the air today?
Well, we often think about efficiency and conservation as the first things we ought to do. That's where we get the best return on our investment. And those two are not the same. We have a language problem when we talk about energy. We think the power is out. Now that means electricity. And we have trouble distinguishing between power and energy. But in the case of conservation and efficiency, efficiency is how well your car engine does at converting the fuel in the gasoline into going down the road. Conservation is human behavior. It's deciding to take the bus instead of driving the car. We need both.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Bill, for being with us today.
Sure. Thank you, Mark.
It's just about 4 o'clock. You are tuned to KTUO in Juneau. We broadcast to 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT Sarsuna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210 AS 89.9. Also online at www.ktuo.org. Coming up tomorrow at 3 on a June afternoon, Pat Moore will be your host. He'll talk with Dixie Belcher and Kathy Hill about some upcoming presentations on community gardens. We'll talk sailing in Southeast Alaska with Sean Boyle. Kathy Ruddy and Bill Overstreet will be here to highlight the Whale's Tail Trail. We'll find out about high school graduation activities. Tomorrow, 3 on a June afternoon. The forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with a chance of rain in the evening, then scattered showers later on. Cloudy skies and scattered showers are expected on Tuesday. Wednesday, mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers. Thanks to Mark Wheeler for producing this show today. This is KTUO News in Juneau.
Set a goal for Afghan forces to take the lead for combat operations across the country in 2013.
President Obama and NATO mark a milestone in the Afghan war. For Monday, May 21st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. NATO leaders wrap up their summit in Chicago. We'll hear about their decisions on the war in Afghanistan and the future role of NATO there. Also this hour, how a Wall Street watchdog has grown sharper teeth despite few resources.
Last year, the SEC's budget was $1.2 billion. Bank of America's total IT expenses were $4.2 billion. So they're really outgunned.
And Game of Thrones actor Peter...